Hello, and welcome to the Queer Newark Oral History Podcast. I'm Kristen Swarsone, your host and a PhD student in American Studies at Rutgers University, Newark. This podcast is a part of the Queer Newark Oral History Project, a community-based and community-driven initiative supported by Rutgers Newark.
Okay, hi, Tim, and welcome. Tim is the co-director of the Queer Newark Oral History Project, along with Professor Whitney Strube here at Rutgers Newark. But I'd like to let you introduce yourself. So if you could tell us a little bit about you.
Sure. I am an associate professor in the history department, and I also teach courses in women's and gender studies and American studies here at Rutgers Newark. I've worked here since 2010. I grew up in the Midwest. I'm a political news junkie.
Me too.
Yeah.
Awesome.
And I'm happy to be here.
Cool. Awesome. Tim was also a guest on this podcast before with Wit, and we talked about the Newark's LGBTQ history. So if you want to check that out as well. So I just have a couple questions for you about oral history, like best practices on how to conduct an oral history interview. So just to start us off, like, what is, like, can you explain what is oral history for those that don't know, why it's useful, and like how it became to be a research methodology?
Absolutely. Great question. Oral history in some ways is just the practice of telling stories and collecting stories, listening to stories. And in that sense, it's kind of no different from something that we all do all the time. And it also has similarities to other fields of inquiry. Like I'm thinking of journalism. It's different in that it's a little bit more formalized, even if it's just, doing oral history with your grandmother, about her, her early life or something like that. I would say oral history became a field as part of the broadening of the field of history to encompass marginalized people. In the 1960s and 1970s, there was sort of a movement in the historical profession for history from below, it was often called at the time. So not just telling the history of people like the president or the king or the mayor or people who left written records, but also of ordinary people, workers, women, in the U.S., African Americans and other people of color, poor people. And it's a way to capture life stories of people who may not have left diaries or written books or kept, the kinds of meeting minutes or other written sources that historians typically try to use. One really important early project, I don't think they called it oral history, but in the 1930s, people working for the federal government did a series of interviews with formerly enslaved people. And that's become a very important source for the history of slavery in the U.S. At that point, they had the few remaining ex-slaves in the U.S. were elderly, right? But they were able to recount for these interviews with New Deal federal workers what their lives had been like in ways that no other source can get at. And in the 1960s and 70s, with women's history and black history and gay and lesbian history, the field kind of exploded as a way of looking at people who whose lives are not available in other kinds of records. So in queer history, there's lots of examples of important works that use oral histories. Alan Berube wrote a book about gay and lesbian people during World War II, where he used government records but also interviewed people about their experiences. And for LGBTQ history, it's an important method because So often people don't want to leave a written record, right? If there is a record of gay and lesbian lives, it's often a record that's created by the police or by some sort of oppressive force. And in fact, you know, not being visible is a strategy that folks use for self-protection, for self-fulfillment, and so on. And so it becomes a key source of evidence. Another oral history project that comes to mind is Liz Kennedy and Madeline Davis wrote a book called Boots of Leather, Slippers of Gold, that's about working class lesbians in Buffalo. Really, really cool early book. That book is based, I think, you know, basically entirely on oral histories. There's still a bias against oral history in the historical, you know, among professional historians, because there's a sense that people may misremember things, and that a document that's written at the time is, you know, unchangeable in a different sense. But
doesn't like the way someone remembers something, even if it's wrong, kind of give you a sense?
Absolutely, absolutely. And of course, the, you know, and written records have their own limitations in that they are mostly, you know, less often the perspectives of marginalized people.
Right.
So, yes, I would say that one of the problems or issues in oral history is how do you deal with the fallibility of memory? In some cases, people have told, you know, stories again and again. I would say this is probably more true interviewing activists, you know, which I did for my own dissertation and then book. You know, sometimes there were stories that they'd told a bunch of times, and there's a kind of rehearsal process. I don't mean to be critical in saying that. It's just a natural phenomenon that happens. You know, interviewing people who are not activists or who, you know, just about their everyday lives or their childhood or growing up doesn't, I find a little bit easier because I'm less worried about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've noticed that when I interviewed someone that had been doing interviews for like a documentary, they, when I asked them questions not about the documentary, it was much more, I guess, like off the cuff. But when it got to like about the documentary, they had like definite, like picked up the pace and knew exactly, you know, like had their thoughts on it all ironed out, you know, and were used to talking about it.
Yeah. Yeah. I found the least interesting oral histories I did for my book on Chicago politics was with politicians.
Yeah. Oh, I bet. Yeah.
You know, you just get kind of a canned story, but most people have interesting stories and, you know, it depends. I won't say everyone likes being interviewed, but, it's often a really good experience as you know, right?
Yeah. And I think it's really cool too, that you can, you know, go home and like you said, you can interview your grandparents, you know, like you can interview elders in your community or whatever. It doesn't have to.
Absolutely. And, I did a couple of interviews with my grandmother before she passed away. Aww. And I love having them.
Yeah. I keep thinking I have to interview my parents and I keep not getting around to it, and I'm going to regret it if I don't do it.
Me too.
Yeah.
My parents.
So I guess for another question, how do you, like when you're in the interview, how do you frame your questions to get the best response? Do you use prompts like tell me a story about or and do you come in there with a set of questions or do you go off the cuff a lot?
I would say it varies somewhat. And to some extent, it's a process of trial and error. You know, what works for one person may not work for another person. I usually, unless I'm, you know, doing a narrow interview for a specific purpose, I sort of say, begin by asking someone to tell me about where they were born and what they remember about their early childhood. People usually have something to say about that. And then about, you know, significant people in their early life. I guess I tend to, I do try to get people kind of on the record about significant transitions, like when they started school, when they, moved to a new home, when people came into or left their lives, just so that, and those tend to be things that people do remember accurately dates for, right? But then other kinds of memories are more open-ended. People, you know, if people may not, may remember having a conversation, but not necessarily like what year it was or.
Right.
So I try to kind of anchor the interview with significant life events, but also kind of ask questions about the flavor of everyday life. Tell me something about, you know, what was your brother like? Or I know Burl Satter suggested a really cool question, which is like, what did you really like to wear for a night out?
Huh, that is a really good question.
Yeah. It depends on the person, and some people, I'm trying to think, how do I frame questions? If I'm struggling, I'll stick to the script, but then if someone kind of delves into it, a topic that I didn't expect, I usually will go.
Yeah.
Go there. Unless I'm pressed for time.
Yeah. Yeah. That actually, cause I'm wondering too, like, how do you sort of gently keep an interviewee on track? I have trouble with this. I'll let people go off the rails. Cause then I'm like, what if it leads to something really interesting and I've cut them off, but sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it's just a tangent.
It is a real dilemma. And it can be off-putting to people to have you to interrupt. Yeah. I mean, there are some interviews where someone just, you have no trouble getting them to talk, but then they want to tell stories that aren't what you're looking for, or it's just really tangential. I try not to just like flat out interrupt, but I wouldn't say I never do it. Try to be kind of gentle, maybe using cues like looking at the person or body language, I guess, to communicate those kinds of things. Obviously harder on a phone interview. What else? Convey a sense that I want to cover these life events or sort of signal that something is, that a topic is winding down. Like, is there anything else you'd like to say about your childhood? Or is there anything else you'd like to add about your coming out experience? Sometimes I ask people to describe what they remember about a space, like their childhood home or their walk to school or even, you know, what they remember about a public event, like in Newark, the Newark Rebellion, I'm doing a project about a scandal. So in my own research, I ask people about like, when and how did you hear about it? There's a sort of famous effect in psychology. You know, everybody remembers where they were when they heard about the Kennedy assassination, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's, you know, the personal significance of news events I find useful and interesting. And with LGBT history, you know, there are certain things like the marriage debate or the debate over gay people in the military or the AIDS crisis that pop up.
I bet that's good for getting people into the mode of then telling stories in regards to other questions.
Yes. Yeah, that's right.
That's cool.
So it depends on the person. But you know, I would encourage people to go with trial and error, right? Get out that tape recorder, or get out that phone,
mm-hmm.
And just start asking questions of your family members, you know, and go from there.
Yeah. And I think that even if you buy like a cheap tape recorder, like the one I use was like $30, and it has the sound is really good. And I also really liked how Svetlana Kito, who came and did our like oral history workshop, she graduated from Columbia, their master's in oral history. And she had said that with her grandfather, she just keeps a recorder on her at all times. And if he starts going into like a really interesting story, she can just turn it on. And so she just
like, so smart.
Yeah, it's really cool. So, but yeah, thank you. This is awesome. And I just wanted to ask you too, like, is there anything else you want to add or anything or plug or where people can find you or anything like that?
You can find me on campus or on, I tweet at, Timothy SW or, come to a Queer Newark Oral History Project event.
Yes.
You're one of our, longest running folks, and at this point you know more about interviewing than I do, I think, so.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
The Queer Newark Oral History Podcast is produced by me, Kristen Scorsone. This episode was recorded in the Queer Newark office located in Conklin Hall at Rutgers University Newark. Our theme music was remixed by DJ Just Love, an amazing local Newark DJ, and is from an original song by Kay Sparks. The title is Music, and you can find more from Kay Sparks on freemusicarchive.org. As for DJ Just Love, you can find her on Twitter, at DJ Just Love, and on Facebook. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.